Welcome to the Bridging Success Podcast. I'm Bo Jenkins, founder and CEO of BridgeNet Technology Consultants, where we solve challenging technology issues for growing businesses. We are the leading customer-focused, community-involved expert technology consultants. Welcome to Bridging Success, the podcast where top B2B CEOs and executives share their insights, challenges, and game-changing strategies that drive innovation and business growth. I'm your host, Bo Jenkins, founder and CEO of BridgeNet Technology Consultants. Each episode, we spotlight visionary leaders shaping the future, diving into critical decisions, leadership philosophies, and breakthrough moments that have propelled them to success. On this episode, I'm happy to welcome Ravi Sawhney, CEO and founder of RKS Design. Ravi is a global design leader and subject matter expert in design and innovation. Ravi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Will. Pleased to be here.
So I loved seeing that Teddy Ruxpin was part of your origin story with starting RKS. I was reading about some of the technology involved in bringing that to market in the mid-80s. Man, tell me about Teddy Ruxpin and how did being a part of that cultural phenomenon contribute to your success over the years? I'd love to hear that story.
Oh, boy. Teddy was a very interesting story. I was approached by a company called Alchemy 2, which were animatronic people who were had been supplying animatronics to the movie industry. And they had developed a kind of a hand-carved, not very attractive teddy bear that they had put a cassette player into, and they used model airplane servos, and they used the left channel to control the servos and the right channel for voice, and they were able to get it to look and talk about Teddy Ruxpin. I started doing this. And they thought this would be great. Now, the part of the beauty of Teddy Ruxpin is that Ken Forsey, who was the inventor of Teddy Ruxpin, had been using Teddy Ruxpin in puppet shows for kids for a long time. So he had all these incredibly rich, tested stories. And so Teddy was a character before he became this animatronic bear. So we were approached to basically take this and reinvent it for manufacturability and for the market. A guy named Don Kingsborough, ex-Atari, came in and started funding it. We started, I think, before Don actually was formally engaged and built Worlds of Wonder. And I basically was a part of a team of three groups. So they had one group, which was mine, to do the body, which meant all the electronics, another group to do all of the head animatronics, and then another group that was just to fill in. The pace was so intense, the other two groups just dropped out. So my group ended up designing all of the head, all of the animatronics, all of the body parts, all of the components go inside of it. Along the way, one of the things that, as an industrial designer, I saw was that all the cassette players available at that time used a double press, if you remember. You press once to stop and once to eject the tape. And it was my observation that, two key observations. One was that it had to look like a regular teddy bear. It should not look like something that is an electronic or a mechanical teddy bear. It's got to look like a cushy, soft teddy bear that comes to life. The other was that younger kids would never be able to get the double push, right? And so what I did on my own was I developed a door that had injection molded cams into it. And when you lifted the door, when you lift the door, the first cam pressed the stop button, and then behind it was another cam that pressed the eject button and lifted the cassette out. So even a three-year-old could basically just open the door and the tape would be there. They could flip it around, put a different tape in, close the door. When you close the door, press play. So those were the two changes I made, aside from basically shaping the body, shaping the headphones, doing everything so it would be this cuddly teddy bear. And then we proposed that you could have an end cap at Toys R Us that Teddy would be at, and which all the way went all the way through to execution. And we'd just sit there with a motion sensor. When people walked by, Teddy would open his eyes and say, "Hi, I'm Teddy Ruxpin." And people would just drop their jaws and just fall in love with the talking teddy bear. So it became quite a phenomenon that year. It was intense. I've never worked so hard in my life as we did on that project. It was 16-hour days, 7 days a week, for months on end. It was so incredibly exhausting. But we pulled it off, and they still made Teddy Ruxpin in a different manifestation than what we did today. Here we are 30 years later, whatever. 30 years, 40 years, I don't know.
40, yeah.
That was 1985, so yeah, it's a while ago. 40 years later, they're still making announcements.
How did that launch your career into design and innovation, and how did that shape what is RKS Designs today?
That's an interesting question. I wouldn't say that Teddy Ruxpin shaped RKS, because I was at a crossroads at that point. And we continued to do work for Alchemy and Worlds of Wonder. But I had bigger ambitions than being just targeted and locked into toy design. Coming out of Xerox in the 70s, I was into the technology and everything else. But mostly I was into human-centered design coming out of Xerox. So I worked with almost 30 psychologists on the first touchscreen interface. That shaped where RKS is more than Teddy Ruxpin. Teddy Ruxpin was a huge point of credibility. And we had people approaching us, including Mattel, to do toy work and others. And I made a decision at that point that I wanted to do other things than only toys. We like doing toys, but we do a lot of different things. It was, I don't know. Financially, was that the best decision at the time? Probably not. The low-hanging fruit as far as financial success at that time was to stay the track and keep just doing toys and be known for doing animatronic toys. But that wasn't where my heart was at. My heart was making, it was always been making people happy and increasing the quality of life for people. And that's what's really driven RKS.
That's great. So I read about the psychoaesthetics framework that you developed. What do you want your listeners to know about your work in that area?
Psychoaesthetics is probably my legacy project as a designer, because it is a full human-centered design thinking methodology that anyone can pick up and use. We may use it if it's a car analogy, we may drive it in fifth or sixth gear, and someone who just starts with it may drive it in first gear. But it is a way to understand your market. It is a way to design viral experiences so that you can propel your product or service. It's got universal application. We use it on branding. We use it on business innovation. We use it, of course, in product design and development. It allows you to really mitigate the risks, I would say, associated with doing anything new and innovative that you're going to bring to the market. And in order to mitigate the risks, you have to really insight and understand the people. You have to be able to map the competitive landscape, the branding, the personas. One of the key things that I developed was the psychoesthetic map, which maps levels of interactivity and self-actualization. And we combine that with a suite of tools, but we also heavily relied on Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey and understanding how to use design and interaction to move people along the journey so that they adopt a new idea, adopt a new product, adopt a new service, and then have successful moments of truth. And that leads to them feeling good about themselves, and in many cases, going viral and posting about it. One of the things coming out of Xerox that I wrote for the firm in 1982 was that It's not how you feel about a design or experience. It's how it makes you feel about yourself. We all know Maya Angelou said, people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. They'll never forget how you made them feel. It's the same. It is the same level of self-affirmation that we all look for from others and our interactions in life that we just tap into in the design process to create that. I'm really enjoying the success of my decisions or my hard work or the money I spent. My simplest example of that is the can opener we did for Xylus. That is the simplest product we've ever designed, probably. And what we did was we studied, and there's hundreds of can openers. And we had an epiphany and studying and watching people open cans and doing it ourselves and really thinking about it. And we said, why is it that you need to puncture the can and you need to rotate the knob or the levers, but you have to keep pretty good control over how much pressure you put on the levers, the handles. And I proposed to the team, I said, why don't we just latch the handles together with a release? Once you puncture the can, the handles are locked together. And then you just turn the knob mindlessly, because we've all had that experience where we get distracted, we loosen up the handles, and now we've got part of the can that hasn't been opened. And now you got to go through the whole thing again. And that small observation about user experience and human interactivity has led to phenomenal success. And that camper has almost 40,000 reviews on Amazon, right? And I don't write reviews on Amazon. To be so happy with your can opener that you would actually write about it is an indication of, that's an indication of understanding. And Cycle 6 is really comprehensive. It could almost be intimidating, but it's like anything. If you use it on a very basic level, you just scratch the surface of it, all your audience would benefit from it.
So take me through, you mentioned the gears that you could drive it in. For the business leaders and CEOs out there listening to this, take me through first gear and how to get started with it and put it into practice. It sounds like it's an emotional design type of, how do you play on the emotions that are involved in the product maybe?
Well, first gear I would say would be psychoesthetic mapping, which would be just mapping the competitive landscape. If you look at the X and Y axis, we're playing levels of interactivity against levels of self-actualization. If you look at it this way, low levels of self-actualization and interactivity are paperclip. Design engineer does its job perfectly, consistently. We don't even think about it when we use it. If we add levels of interactivity to the far, we would say a skip loader. It's got eyes, feet, sight, sound, everything going on, but it's not necessarily self-actualizing to the operator. It might be to you or I, Bo, if the first time we got in one and we were able to go tear down a house, we'd be excited about it. But for the operator, it's just a tool. It's a very complex tool. On the other side, we say what would be low interactivity and high self-actualization would be the Mona Lisa. You don't get to touch it. You don't get to smell it. You don't get to interact with it. You just get to look at it. But it's so self-actualizing that you remember seeing it like it was yesterday for the rest of your life. And that's that extreme. And then if we say, what is the combination of high self-actualization and high interactivity? An example, it's different for everyone in every case, would be a sports car. The look of the car, the performance of the car, how it changes someone's persona when they're in that car, right? And so that basically forms four quadrants, and each quadrant could be rich and successful. It's how much do you move in that quadrant? So what we do is that we work as a team, and we qualitatively place and debate where each of the competitive products would go. That would be the very first level. And it's also interesting that it's a great team building exercise. And having been in design now for 50 years, I can't tell you how many meetings that used to happen where everyone would leave the room in agreement, but in their mind, they were agreeing to different things. When you visualize it, everybody syncs up. And in the global market, it especially is good because it's visual. It bridges language and it bridges disciplines. At the C-level, when we did the global design language for Life Technologies, went from a $5 billion market cap to an exit of, I forget, it was about 15 billion, give or take a billion, a rounding error, that we were able to, we had interviewed the CEO, CTO, and CMO, but within 2 hours, we showed them the psychostatic mapping, we showed them personas, and we showed them options for design languages that fit into what we identified as the white space. So by mapping, then you can collectively say, where's the white space? The next level is when you start mapping personas. So as we develop the personas, and then in their role is, in the case of Life Technologies, we looked at chief scientists, CEOs, technicians, the whole suite, and you start to see how you can map how they feel about where these products would be. And when we started, we thought it was about needs and speeds, but in fact, they were thinking about what they were doing was going to increase the quality of life for people on the planet. And they were looking for something that was a trophy of scientific success to affect people. So that moved them into the upper right. And so what we did was we placed them in the upper right. And what we found over time is that really creates the opportunity zone. So you're looking, making sure that you're not overlapping offerings that are already there, right? That, and you're looking for how much do you have to move your products either on the self-actualization scale or the interactivity scale to really nail the market. Because people are looking for advancement always. That's a human condition. Always looking to be something more today than we were yesterday. We do that in products. We do that in our life. We do that just continuously. So it really is, I laugh because I say, I probably should have taken a lot more psychology classes instead of just being this observationist person, but I've picked it up over the years. I started to look at design as a tool to affect the psyche of people. And I think what's key to the listeners is that your challenge is that how do you motivate someone to do something new for themselves that they might otherwise not do?
That's great. I love that. I love that. I heard you say a quadrant, right? And we had a paperclip, the Mona Lisa, a sports car, and an excavator. Did I get that right?
Yep.
All right, great. So let's cut to a different angle here for a minute and talk about, let's bring Teddy Ruxpin to the 21st century and talk about what customer expectations and what technology changes are doing to deliver cutting edge solutions. And how does RKS stay ahead of that curve? How do you engage the team to always be innovating and creating new things and staying on top of all those changes?
It's interesting that if you look at RKS's portfolio of work, you don't see what's called a house style. And that is because we are basically the voice of the consumer on steroids. And so in order to do that, what RKS does is it does a lot of ethnography. We do a lot of technology scouting. We do a lot of foundational work to really build a strong foundation. And along with that starts to become more of a trend analysis. Where are people going? What are they doing? In many cases, we invent the technology then to fulfill their needs and aspirations, or I would even say unarticulated needs and aspirations. So what we do is and that's led us to refresh ourselves every day so that we stay current, we stay ahead of the curve, because it's people who are changing and are driving through their expectations, because as a consumer, you're latching on to whatever is the latest and greatest advancement. As designers and innovators, we have to look at that and say, okay, what does that mean? You know, we can't tell people what they should want. We have to understand what they would love that doesn't exist. So don't. And that's always the challenge, is that if you ask people what they want, they can only tell you what they know. We know what could be, they know what they know, and we need to advance beyond that. As the famous quote from Henry Ford is, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. Yeah. You know, if we had been there, we would have said, why do you need a faster horse? And we would have started digging, because we do this qualitative interviews. Why do you need a faster horse? What's wrong with your existing horse? Where do you have to be faster? And when you start to dig in and understand, because then we would say, if we could make affordable technology, then that would solve their needs and aspirations, and it would be self-actualizing for them, because it would give them a new experience that they never had, in a sense of empowerment that they might not have with a horse, because the horse has got a brain and it delivers a ride. But just thinking about it, it's like, I drive my car, I'm the brain. I do some of the advanced technology in the cars. I like when I'm starting to fade from one lane to the other, that puts me back in the lane. I also have my wife to remind me of that as well.
So speaking of design and technology, what's next for RKS? Can you share any exciting innovations you and the team are currently exploring?
Oh my God. There's usually about a dozen projects that are going on. So we're always working on some level of laboratory equipment. We're working on a variety of different consumer products, anything from advanced technology in food storage to, it's very interesting because in the office, one team you'll see, they'll be working on the next generation sequencer. And next to them, you see the team that's working on developing the best dog bed in the world. And the next team over, we're working on an advanced toothbrush, second generation toothbrush that has four heads that we've rebranded and renamed Quattro. And then we're working on just in the process of an M&A with a company we called Loan Gifting merged, and I renamed it Finita, all about student debt reduction. And now we're doing a merger with another group, and we're going to take it into an AI solution for student debt reduction. So we've incubated companies using psychosthetics, the whole idea of how to solve the student debt crisis came out of the psychosthetic exercise. There's just a wide variety of, from business innovation and talking to someone who's a congressman now, who's running for Senate. And now we're talking about how can we use human-centered design thinking through psychosthetics to really understand what people truly want out of a politician. Why would they really attach themselves to that person, almost like a product, and make it viral? So it's interesting times, very interesting times.
Really neat stuff. From a toothbrush to dog beds to student loan forgiveness, it's amazing the spectrum there. I was reading an article about Mattel and them trying to develop or input AI into the Barbie doll so that they can actually remember a conversation and have a story to go along with the kid that buys the Barbie doll. Knowing the past with Teddy Ruxpin, I was really hoping you'd have Mattel in there somewhere. But
and we'll see if that's a good application. Teddy was beautiful and is beautiful because it's passive until you do something to bring it to life. Right. That's another part of the human condition. We just love humanizing things. Our pets are great examples. We look for the traits. Every day we look for the traits in our dog that are our dogs that are human. One's mostly husky and he talks. My wife is, she's got his words that he can that he can say. And but do you really want that in everything? Do I really want my doorknob to say, "Welcome back, Robbie"? I don't. Welcome home. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't.
But people are going to test the boundaries. But AI is not for everything everywhere. But who knows? You know, who knew that it would be this powerful, this fast?
It is making some changes, rapid changes, that's for sure. Rapid adoption, and I'm keeping my ear to the track on it and trying to keep up. Just to try and wrap it up and put a bow on it, Robbie, what's one key takeaway or piece of advice you'd like to share with the listening audience about pursuing innovation and excellence in design?
Well, of course, I would say take a look at psychoesthetics, because that can be a toolkit that will make you be more effective, will move you along faster. It's foundational work. They're living documents. You update them. It can help you navigate the difficulty. Again, the challenge is, how do you get someone to adopt something new and understanding about what does it really mean to be human-centered? Because at the end of the day, we're all making decisions. And it's not just about emotion. It's about emotion and cognition and self-actualization and interactivity. And when you nail all of those, then you create success. So it's really an understanding that it's a global economy. There's a lot of smart people out there. There's a lot of people who are really pushing the envelopes. Sometimes they do it in ways that they're a solution looking for a problem, and other people are really nailing it. But sometimes you don't have to do a lot to make people's lives better and to move the needle and create a company or expand your company or sustain your current company.
It could be as simple as a locking handle on a can opener.
That's right.
So
if simple as the millions and millions of can openers that people buy because the handle's locked together.
So if our listeners want to learn more about psychoesthetics or look more into RKS designs and stay updated on your latest projects and development, how do they do that?
LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. RKS Designs on LinkedIn. We post fairly often. We do have a mail list. We put out case studies, how we did things fairly often. Psychoesthetics 2.0 is available on Amazon. And so they can either get it through Kindle, or they can get a hard copy. I've really made it affordable. We really just sell it at a break even, because it's really about the rising tide floats all boats type of approach. And that if we can increase the quality of design and innovation for everyone, it's just a better world. Psychosex 2.0 is on Amazon and Kindle. The website RKS Design is really becoming very robust, very much loaded with quality information about how things are done. And then, of course, through LinkedIn. And then I get a ton of emails, but my email is easy. It's ravi@rksdesign.com.
Great, Ravi. Thanks so much for being on today. I really enjoyed talking to you, and best of luck.
Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
This is Bo. Thank you so much for listening to the Bridging Success Podcast. If you are a successful business owner who would like to be on this program, please visit podcast.bridgenetllc.com to sign up. If something in this episode connected with you, would you mind sharing it on social media? Just take a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend, or share it on your favorite social media platform. If you know someone that would be a great guest, tag them on social media with the hashtag #BridgingSuccess and let them know about the show. I love seeing your posts and guest suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss any, go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, your ratings, and reviews, they go a long way to help promote the show and mean a lot to me and my team. Want to know more? Go to our website, bridgenetllc.com, or follow me on LinkedIn. Find me on Facebook at /bjakins, or on Instagram at Bo Jenkins. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.